Let me indicate that we are kind of late on our schedule. We committed that we
be right into the record that because we have the National Treasury present, that they confirm the contents of this letter as well, with your permission, Chairperson, before I proceed to the submissions.
Go ahead, Advocate.
Thanks, Chairperson. No, I wanted to.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. So yes, I don't have the annexure in front of me right now, but the letter was signed by the Minister of Finance with the attachment with the agreements between the National Treasury and the Department of Transport on the outstanding issues and the proposals that we had agreed on for amendments to clauses within the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can we go to Annexure 4 of the bundle of documents that we forwarded to? It's written Annexure 4. Unfortunately, it's not numbered. It's immediately after the letter. Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. We start off at clause 7. Okay. The current provision in the bill reads as follows. The 7.1, clause 7.1, the administrator is governed by a board consisting of the following members: A, the chief executive officer; B, no more than 12 members appointed by the minister with qualifications in at least 10 years experience in one or more of the fields of medicine, disability management, medical health insurance, hospital management, public finance, public transport, information technology systems, actuarial sciences and the law. C, the Director General of the National Department of Transport or his or her delegate. D, the Director General of National Treasury or his or her delegate. E, the Director National of the National Department of Health or his or her delegate. And F, the Director General of National Department of Social Development or his or her delegate. 2, before the members of the board contemplated in subsection 1B are appointed, the minister must, through the national media, invite nominations from members of the public for these positions on the board. 3, the minister must publish the list of nominees, their qualifications, experience by notice in the Gazette. 4, with the exception of the academic employees, with the exception of the academic employees of the higher education institutions as defined in the Higher Education Act 97, the members of the board contemplated in subsection 1B may not be persons employed by the state. 5, the minister must, within 30 days from the date of appointment of a member of the board, notify Parliament of the appointment and give notice of the appointment in the Gazette. 6, the chief executive officer and the directors general are ex officio members of the board but may not vote at its meeting. Now, we go to the column written comments from National Treasury, composition of the board. National Treasury suggests that a, quote, consideration should be given to reducing 12 to 6 members. Two, Section 7.6 provides the CEO and the DGs are ex officio members of the board and, quote, may not vote at its meetings. National Treasury suggests that a consideration should be given to the removal of this restriction, close quote. Our response to that is we've noted the comments and suggest the reformulation of clause 7 as follows. 7.1, the administrator is governed by a board consisting of the following members, the chief executive, the chief financial officer, C, no more than 10 members appointed by the minister with qualifications in and at least 10 years experience in one or more of the fields of medicine, disability management, medical health, insurance, hospital management, public finance, public transport, information technology system, actuarial science and law. The Director General of the National Department of Transport or his or her delegate. The Director General of the National Treasury or his or her delegate. The Director General of the National Department of Transport Health or his or her delegate. And the Director General of the Department of Social Development or his or her delegate. Two, before members of the board completed in one are appointed, the minister must through the national media invite nominations from members of the public for these positions on the board. Three, a minister must publish in the list of nominees their qualifications and experience by notice in the Gazette. With the exception of the academic employees of higher education institutions as defined in the Higher Education Act, the members of the board contemplated in subsection 1B may not be persons employed by the state. Five, the minister must within 30 days from the date of appointment of a member of the board notify Parliament of the appointment and give notice of the appointment in the Gazette. Six, all members of the board may vote at its meeting. Then we move on to the next page. Term of office, clause 9, it reads as follows. The members of the board contemplated in section 1, subsection 1B, hold office for a period of 3 years and may be reappointed for one further period not exceeding 3 years. The term of office, the next paragraph, this is the National Treasury's comment. Section 9.1 provides for a term of office of the board. Section 9.1 provides for a term of office of board members of the 3 years and reappointment for one further three-year period. National Treasury argues that the period is too short given that the time involved in understanding and engaging with the issues at hand. Therefore, a four-year term might be appropriate. We responded as follows. The department does not agree with the suggestion and maintains that a three-year term as appropriate term of office. Clause 13, meetings. 13.1, the board must meet as often as the business of the administrator may require. Two, the board must devise the procedures for its meeting and decisions and those of its committees, provided that a quorum for any meeting of the board or a committee shall be a majority of the members entitled to vote. B, if there is disagreement, decisions of the board or a committee shall be taken by a majority of votes cast. And C, the person presiding at the meeting of the board shall have a casting vote in addition to his or her deliberative vote. Three, the board or a committee may invite any person to attend a meeting for purposes of advising or informing it on any matter. Our response thereto, department notes, comments, and proposed new clause 33, which provides for the consideration of actuarial valuations in terms of clause 33. The administrator, the minister of finance, the minister of health, and the minister of social development, or their delegates, shall meet within 3 months from the end of the financial year. The underlying word, chairperson, reflect the amendments or the in-principle agreement. That's the change. Of receipt by the administrator of the actuarial valuations contemplated in section 32 to consider the financial position of the administrator and any remedial actions that may be necessary. The meeting shall consider the adjustment of the tariff and treatment protocols, annual average national income, pre-accident annual income cap, lump sum, funeral benefit, and the limit on the provision of vocational training. We've discussed clause 33 in detail below, so we've just made that note. Clause 16, 2B, it reads as follows. It's titled Conduct. 16 sub A, sub 1 provides, a member of the board may not be employed or contracted to a position that will conflict with the proper performance of his or her functions. 2, a member of the board may not A, attend, participate in, vote or influence the proceedings during a meeting of the board or a committee if in relation to the matter before the board or a committee, that member has an interest, including a financial interest, that precludes him or her from acting in a fair, unbiased, and proper manner. Or B, make private use of or profit from any confidential information obtained as a result of performing his or her functions as a member of the board. 3, for purposes of subsection 2A, a financial interest means a direct material interest of a monetary nature or to which a monetary value may be attributed and does not include the interest held in any fund or investment if the member who holds the interest cannot influence the decision of that fund or investment. Our response thereto is we agree, department agreed to refer the appropriate sections in the Public Finance Management Act, section 50 thereof. Clause 26, title current provision and financing of administrator. 26.1, in respect of its liabilities provided for in Chapter 6, the administrator must be financed on a fully funded basis. Benefits must be paid from its reserves and its liabilities may not exceed accumulated reserves after adjustment at the year end. The administrator is the administrator is funded from A, the Road Accident Benefit Scheme levy as provided for in the Customs and Excise Act 1964, B, monies as may be appropriated by Parliament. The National Treasury recommended that Section 26 of the bill be omitted and that the preamble of the bill be amended. And they also suggested that the bill must, quote, provide for separate funding, budgeting, and accounting for the administration and for the funding of benefits, including the different and appropriate budgeting and financial approval rules. These separate arrangements should be carried through into all sections of the bill. National Treasury 9, National Treasury also proposes the following additions to Clause 26. The Minister of Transport must, at least every 24 months, submit to Parliament an actuarial evaluation of the scheme. If the evaluation indicates that the scheme is not in a sound financial position, the Minister must, A, take all the appropriate steps provided for in the Act, B, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, undertake a review of the benefits or an adjustment of revenue sources or both, taking into account the requirements of the Constitution, the impact on the public and the fiscal position of government. And C, if the review recommends an adjustment of any benefit or the implementation of a scheme or arrangement aimed at restoring the scheme to a sound financial position or both, undertake the requisite legal process. 10. National Treasury further suggests that the provision, quote, for actuarial assessment should be included in Chapter 4 and appropriate benchmarks should be provided for. Should be provided for the financial sustainability and review of the benefits, procedure and funding. The new proposal reads as follows. 26, the benefit account. 1, the administrator must open and maintain a benefit account. 2, the benefit account shall consist A, road accident benefit levies imposed in terms of the Customs and Excise Act, 1964. B, money as may be appropriated by Parliament. C, money loaned to the administrator. D, interest earned on money in the account. E, investment returns on investment on invested money from the account. 27, application of money in the benefit account. A, 1, the money in the benefit account shall, subject to the provisions of the Act, be under the control of the Chief Executive Officer and shall be applied by the Chief Executive Officer for A, payment of benefits provided for in Chapter 6 of this Act, B, the cost related to the appointment of and the fees of curators appointed to assist claimants and beneficiaries. C, subject to approval by the Minister of Transport, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, transfers to the transition account, and D, the payment of expenses related to the maintenance of the benefit. 28, transaction account. The administrator must open and maintain a transition account. The transition account shall consist of A, money that belongs to the Road Accident Fund prior to effective date of this Act, B, money as may be appropriated by Parliament, C, money as may be transferred into the transition account subsequent to the approval contemplated in Section 27C, D, money loaned to the administrator, E, interest earned on money in the transition account, F, investment returns on invested money from the account. 29, the application of money in the transition account. The money in the transition account shall, subject to the provisions of this Act, be under the control of the Chief Executive Officer and shall be applied by the Chief Executive Officer for A, payment of third-party compensation, expert reports and litigation expenses under the RAF Act 96 in respect of claims that arose prior to the coming into effect of this Act, and B, the payment of expenses related to the maintenance of the transition account. 30, operations account. The administrator must open and maintain an operations account. The operations account shall consist of A, money as may be appropriated by Parliament, B, money as may be donated or bequeathed to the administrator, C, money that may become due to the administrator in terms of any other legislation, D, interest earned on money in the operations account, E, investment returns on invested money from the account, and F, money recovered in terms of any insurance or reinsurance scheme. 31, the application of money in the operations account. The money in the operations account shall, subject to the provisions of this Act, be under the control of the Chief Executive Officer and shall be applied by the Chief Executive Officer for A, the payment of administrative expenditure arising from the duties of the administrator set out in Section 5 of this Act, B, the payment of administrative expenditure arising from the powers of the administrator set out in Section 6 of this Act, C, the payment of remuneration and allowances for the board as provided for in Section 14 of this Act, D, the payment of all non-claim liabilities of the former Road Accident Fund as provided for in Section 63 of this Act, and E, the cost of the actuarial evaluations contemplated in Section 32. 32, actuarial valuations. 1, the assets and the liabilities to the funded to be funded respectively from the benefit account and the transition account shall be valued annually by an actuary appointed by the administrator to determine the sufficiency of the money in the respective accounts. 2. The result of the evaluations referred to in subsection 1 shall be included in the administrator's annual report. 3. Subject to sub 4, the liabilities of to be paid from the benefit account must, in the long term, be financed on a fully funded basis. 4. In the event that the ratio of actuarial value of the assets to liabilities of the benefit account at year-end, expressed as percentages, falls below 90%, the minister must take all reasonable steps provided for in the Act to restore the ratio to 90% or above, and must, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, undertake a review of the benefits or an adjustment of revenue sources or both. 33. Consideration of the actuarial valuations. 1. The administrator, the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Health, and the Minister of Social Development, or their delegates, provided that such delegates are not those contemplated in Section 7C to F of this Act, shall meet within 3 months from the end of the administrator's financial year to consider the actuarial valuations contemplated in Sections 32 and to consider the financial position of the administrator and any remedial actions that may be necessary. 2. In addition to the matter contemplated in subsection 1, at the meeting, the respective ministers specified in section 60 shall consider the adjustment of the tariff and treatment protocols, annual average national income, pre-accident annual income, cap, lump sum funeral benefit, and the limit on the provision of vocational training. Clause 28. The current provision of liability of owner or driver and employer of the driver. Now it reads as follows. No civil action for damages in respect of bodily injury or death of any person caused by or arising from a road accident shall lie against A. the owner or driver of a vehicle involved in the road accident, or B. the employer of the driver. Comment from National Treasury. They recommended that Section 28 should be expanded to include indemnity of pedestrians or other persons who might be determined to be responsible for road accidents. It's also important that there should be an appropriate limitation of indemnity in respect of cases deliberately causing an accident, malicious intent, or driving under the influence of alcohol. Flowing from that, we suggested the following reformulation of Clause 27.4. The liability of the administrator is limited to payment for the provision of emergency health care services if A. the injured person is not a citizen or permanent resident of the Republic, or the holder of a valid permit or visa issued in terms of Immigration Act of 2000 or Refugees Act of 98. Then B, the claimant or the beneficiary drove the vehicle or was conveyed in or on the vehicle during the course of the commission of or in the furtherance of a crime listed in Schedule 1 of the Criminal Procedure Act of 1977, or Section 65 of the National Road Traffic Act 1996, for which crime the claimant or beneficiary was convicted, or paid an admission of guilt fine. C. The claimant or the beneficiary sustained a bodily injury during the course of the commission of or in the furtherance of a crime listed in Schedule 1 of the Criminal Procedure Act or Section 65 of the National Traffic Act 96, for which the claimant or the beneficiary was convicted or paid an admission of guilt fine. Or D, the claimant or the beneficiary sustained the bodily injury intentionally. 5, the liability of the administrator to a dependent of a person who dies in circumstances contemplated in subsection 4D is limited to the provision of a funeral benefit. 6, the liability of the administrator to a dependent of a person who dies in circumstances contemplated in subsections 4A, B, or C is limited to the provision of funeral benefit if the dependent is not a citizen or permanent resident or the holder of a valid permit or visa issued in terms of the Immigration Act or the Refugees Act. Clause 59, titled Regulations and Certain Notices by the Minister. 59.1, the Minister must prescribe, G, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, the average annual national income. National Treasury indicated that the bill proposes that deemed income be set at average national income, but, quote, no substantive definition of average national income is provided, close quote. The National Treasury suggests the following alternatives. A, one option would be to replace the average annual national income with an expression which more accurately captures the intent of the bill, which is that the minimum income support reference income should be determined administratively, taking relevant considerations into account. B, a second alternative to replace reference to average annual national income with reference to the national minimum wage or an amount calculated by reference to the national minimum wage. We suggested the following amendment to the definition of average national income. Quote, the average annual national income means the amount based on the average annual after-tax income earned in the Republic for the whole of the employed and unemployed population between the ages of 18 and 59, inclusive, calculated in accordance with the methodology prescribed by the Minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. Chairperson, those were the in-principle agreements flowing from my meeting and as confirmed by the two ministers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In agreement, Treasury? Speak to the...
Yes, ma'am. There were some concessions made, but we are in agreement with that the bill adequately addresses the concerns that we had raised in the report.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Akbar. Honorable members, there we are. The entire agreement between Treasury and National Department of Transport has been read into the records. Are there takers? Honorable Mpanza, Advocate Mulaudzi, Honorable Siabe, Honorable Sibande, and Honorable Ramatlaka. They go, Honorable, we had already made apologies on behalf of those who arrived late that they were still held up in other committees, tourism, police, and many. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I think one must just welcome the joint response. I think it's very helpful indeed, and it's tabulated in a very clear manner. But, Chair, I just want to check, since there is a confirmation that both departments take ownership of this submission. On clause 7, it talks about a new proposal. Now, I think if it's a new proposal, so it means that it's a proposal that is agreed upon by these two departments. But if you go to Clause 59, right at the end. Now you hear something that says the department suggests, which is the Department of Transport. It's not a proposal now, because I thought that we'll be moving in that spirit. And I just want to hear what does that mean? Chair, then same on the same clause number 7. I just want to check on the issue of the ex officio. Of course, then there is an agreement, but I just want to check what is the normal practice when it comes to structures like this. Because the normal practice is that the functionaries, most of the time, they are ex-officials. Now here, the treasurer was arguing that they should be voting, they should have voting powers, and the department is like of transport agreeing to that one. And then it's even repeated and, on number 6, that all members of the board may vote at its meetings. But I just want to check, are we deviating from the normal practice? And then when we go to clause 9, Chair, here there is no agreement between Treasurer and the Department of Transport. And I just want to check, how do they plan to break that deadlock? Because they are arguing on the 4-year term, the others they are saying three-year term. So which is which? Yeah, which is the final one? 4 years or 3 years? And then, Chair, on clause 26, that's where now I start to get confused in terms of the format. Because all along the format has been going very well up to 16. And then on clause 26 now, when you go to the new proposal, it says 26, and then it then moves to 27 up to 33. Now I don't know when it's moving in that way, from 26 clause, and then when it's proposal, then it's 26 up to 33. It's a little bit confusing, because then when you go to clause 20, and then it jumps to from clause, it moves from 26 then to clause 28, but in the proposal it's up to 33. Now I think we should find another way of aligning the numbering. And then, Chair, my last comment is that one that I've asked, that on clause 59, the Department of Transport suggests the following amendment to the definition, but we don't hear whether the Treasurer agrees to that suggestion. Because normally they've been talking about new proposals, but now it's a suggestion now. So whether they agree or not, thank you, Chair.
Honourable Siabe.
Thanks, Chair. And you'll pardon me because I'm interacting with the process. For the first time, I just take it for granted that the column titled response is what the two departments are agreeing on. I'm just taking it for granted, but I will be clarified. But on clause 7, under response, if you go down there on page 2, it says the board contemplated in subsection 1B may not be persons employed by the state. But if you go up there, 1B refers to the chief executive, the chief financial officer. I just take maybe under the composition and appointment of the board, the current provision, that's where it is clear. Maybe there's that kind of confusion. But again, I'm not sure whether I did the correct thing. I was trying to read the responses together with the bill. I'm confused about the clauses, because these clauses in the response, they don't necessarily correspond with the clauses in the bill. I'm not sure whether it's me, and I'll say you must pardon me, I'm a new member, so that I can be assisted to read it correctly. So the clauses in terms of numbering are not necessarily the same as in the bill. Now, my last question is, when you say current reading or current formulation, are you referring to the current formulation in the bill, or is it the current formulation in the ref? I'm also confused there. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Siabi. Honorable Msibande.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'll try. Number one, Chairperson, I wanted maybe to thank both the ministers to respond to us. But nevertheless, what is very much interesting is that the things which are dealing with now, it is in a meeting. I mean, it was an outcome of the meeting, which was in principle agreement. I think that one must be taken very seriously, because I know there are people who used to take chances afterwards. Normally, some people, they used to say, we put it on record. It must be on record that this was in an agreement. Then secondly, nevertheless, then, Chairperson, if you go further, then, in the responses from the department about the issue of the members, if you go to in your responses, in clause number 7, in 6, in your responses, you see, I wanted the clarity that, because this it talks about the all board members, but it doesn't clarify about the issue of the quorum. I think there's supposed to be an issue of the quorum, because most of the boards are killed by the issue of the quorum. It must be taken this again. And then again, if you go to clause number 9.1, you see, I'm a little bit disturbed, because in terms of the office now, there are issues which were clarified. And then in terms of the Office of the Treasury, there was a proposal. And then that proposal, his argument said, the National Treasury argued that the period is too short, given the time of involvement of understanding and whatever it might be. But here, the department, they didn't agree with this suggestion. But I would be happy if you can maybe clarify it broader than this. I'd like to say we didn't agree. What about the lay person on the street? Maybe you find this document as it is, and then you can't get an explanation that what was happening exactly. And then also, somewhere you were talking about the issue of accounts. Oh, before that, also. Yes. Also, Chairperson, I was happy when
you were explaining what was raised with the at Clause 26. Because Clause 26, a lot of people will use it as inunu, as Sluan, as if it's not constitutional. But here, I'm happy because you put it categorically straight that as it is, it was like this, and also the response from the Treasury, the proposal from the Treasury, and also the new proposals which have you have outlined. And with that, if you go down then, may you please clarify for me, because I'm a little bit concerned about this number of accounts. If you go to, in your response, in the same section, in terms of number 28, the transitional account, you talk about transitional account, and then you also talk about which account. There is another account which you talk about. Operational account. You know, what I'm requesting is that if you may further clarify it, I'll put an example. I will always maintain my stance in terms of some of these monies, because once they are being paid out, I assume here you're talking about the money which is held by the RAFs, if we agree about the RAFs bill. You don't talk about the money which is already going out, because with the money which is going out, which is via the lawyers and the like, it doesn't reach the victim. And the people, they don't talk about the interest of those monies. It just disappears. I thought that maybe, if you can clarify on that one, what is happening between the two. And then also, I have noted. Yes. If you go down in terms of your explanation, in terms of operation accounts, if you go to 30, let me see. Yes, if you go, no. Consideration in your consideration of actual valuation. If you go to slide number, I think it's page 13. If you go to the issue of lump sum in terms of the funeral benefits, you see, to me, I'm a little bit concerned because the picture created as if lump sum of the funeral benefit is very huge, while in the past there was an argument of that 10,000 rand. I don't know. May you please clarify that one? What do you mean exactly? Because people, they were assuming that already. If you recall very well, during our public hearings, a lot of people were concerned about that issue of funeral arrangement, whatever. If you can clarify it, because now it's silence, just a benefit scheme. It doesn't clarify exactly what do you mean. And then again, I'll maybe chop one so that you can give the to our colleagues. I think here on slide number 15 or page 15, in terms of administration and some of these things, injuries of people and the like, if maybe you can clarify us, if you go to number 6, where you talk about the liabilities of the administration and dependents, et cetera, I think here, I'm subject for correction, you are trying to address the issue of no fault. Remember, a lot of people were arguing that others were saying no fault is correct, others were saying the issue of no fault is going to encourage this and this and this and this and this. Therefore, I'll request you, maybe if you can clarify us on that one. At the moment, I'll leave it to the chairperson so that my colleagues can come.
Honorable Mlaudzi.
Thanks, chairperson. I would like also to record my apology that I will leave immediately after presentation, asking these clarifying questions. I have to go to the to the house. Firstly, I saw the letter by the ministers, but according to paragraph 3 of the letter, the letter is talking about the agreement in principle. The word in principle, agreement, it means that the agreement is not totally a final agreement. So we can't rely on the letter in principle. We need a real letter to say that we have agreed upon on whatever the Department of Transport in this amendment bill is doing by the Treasury and the Minister of Transport. Let me move out from the letter. Clause 9, as Honorable Mpanza has said, the department shows that it's in disagreement with the National Treasury. On that point, whose point must we take it serious? Between the National Treasury and the department, if there is a disagreement, can we be cleared on on that? Again, we have clause 26, which the department didn't elaborate clearly about the disagreement or the input from the Treasury. You only explained to us your responses from the department about the administrator, the account, and everything. So I wanted to know that, are you in agreement with the input from the Treasury on clause 26.1? The other issue which I wanted to raise is the availability today of the Treasury. This question I'm directing straight to the Treasury. Last time when we asked questions, they said they can't respond on your behalf. So my first question to Treasury is that, are you going to fund through your fiscals or government fiscals the RAPS, Road Accident Benefit Scheme? And if so, yes, and how are you going to fund again the outstanding bill or outstanding amount to be paid to the claimant in terms of RAF? How are you going to sustain yourself? Do these two systems, the Road Accident Fund, which is currently in overdraft, and also the new RAPS. We want a clarity from you that no, you will fund this thing, it will work. And you must tell us, if you will fund it, how are you going to get money? Because we don't want to force the legislation which will never work, like the e-toll. You saw what the e-toll did. They push it to the throat of the people of Gauteng. It's now a white elephant. So we don't want these RAPs to turn to be a white elephant. So another question is about the amount to any budget to assist the claimant. Let's say the poor claimant in our rural area, in order to facilitate the lodgement of the claim to the administrator, where are these people going to get money to assist themselves in terms of this up and down, getting medical reports, police report, accident reports, fax, email, and everything? Do you have a budget for that as the Treasury to assist the RAPs to continue like that? There is the issue of the unconstitutionality of the bill. So, because if the administrator, you said he can adjust the benefit according to the affordability on its own, is unconstitutional, because it's vague on its own. We don't know when there will be an affordability to pay for the injury. We're talking about the people who can die on the road, the people who can be crippled on our roads. And again, it can be unconstitutional if the tariff, in terms of the constitutional court ruling, the agreement in terms of tariffs between the Department of Health and the Department of Transport, the tariffs agreement with the private sector medical institutions, that if a person is in accident, this can happen. Up to now, there is no agreed tariff. It means if these RAPs can be passed, a person involved in the accident will rely only on the state hospital, which we all agree that the state hospital is on the stage of collapse. There's nothing in the state, there's nobody amongst this room who would like to go and be admitted in the state hospital who has a medical aid today. Why? Because there is a state of collapse in our public health sector. So there is no agreement now with the private health sector. There is no agreement of tariffs. So if the private health sector, after we pass this bill, object that they won't service our people because there is no agreement, it means our people will be exposed to the public health center, which is not yet stable. Why don't we wait until we stabilize our health system in the country? Maybe this NHI, which is coming, which will be better for everybody, because you will be involved in an accident, you don't have a medical aid, nothing will happen to you except to go to the state, they will have no bandage, they will only give you Panadol, as is happening now. So you are going to expose the poor people in danger. So the other thing which I wanted to know is about the outstanding amount, which is now is about 300 billion from RAFs to be paid about the claim, past previous claimant. Do you have such amount as the treasury to pay those claims, apart from budgeting again for RAFs? If so, you must tell us so that we must be clear that if the money is there. So the last thing which I want to ask Chairman is the determination of the intentional injury. How will what is the scale to determine whether this accident was intentionally planned, that I want to be injured and claim? How the administrator will determine that, because administrator is not a court. So, Chairperson, let me stop here for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thought you were going to say the red elephant as in the ethos. Honorable Humsinga, you wanted to speak? Okay. You'll speak after Honorable Ramatlakana. Honorable De Freitas, would you want to engage also? Okay. Honorable, okay. Thank you. Honorable Ramatlakana.
No, thank you, Honorable Chair. Just a quick ones as well. From my side, the first question for me, Chair, when the presentation goes in detail, I'm struggling to answer this question myself, so I want if you can help me to answer it. The object of the bill, as it stands, is a kind of removal of the fault. What is on the table based on the discussion between Treasury and the Department? Is it still no fault, or is it partial? Because in the middle of the presentation, there's something about self-infliction and an exclusion on all of this that is called, or you're driving the car yourself, you close your eyes because you want to get money. Anybody that drives a car and closes their eyes is want to die. It's nothing about getting money. So I'm just trying to find this logic. So is it no fault, or is it partial? That's really the big first question I need to just get clear in my mind, because as I'm reading it, and all of what we need to do around the issue about non-South African citizen and all of that, if you can explain that for me. So that's the first question. The second question is generally the money question. In the presentation where there's some concessions made between the department, there is something that says there will be this meeting of the ministers that has an implication of downwards or upwards. In fact, this is actually downwards adjustment. Any language that reads upwards adjustment doesn't exist. So it's actually, because it says it needs to look at the implication so that in terms of now is in the realm of affordability. So I just want to find out this meeting that is going to decide, because now there's a protocol, there's whole loads of tariffs that get into it. It suggests to me is tariffs that looks at downward adjustment, because the cooperative word is affordability and the implication, ability to fund. What is the anticipated outcome of this meeting of the two ministers? You do say, advocate, when you present, you say they will follow a legal route they will follow. I don't know, yet it's not explained what the legal route means with respect to the, if it's a downward adjustment, or implication, where does the implication fall? Does it fall on the other tariffs, which is are not affecting the victims, or is it the generic? And if it's a generic, there is a built-in mechanism for change. If that changes, what then happens to the claimants or those who are expecting to receive X amount, and the meeting decide that that X amount is unaffordable? I'm just trying to find out, in this bill, is there obligation, for, and I maybe put differently, for the outcome of that meeting with two ministers, for the consultation, and in consultation agreeing to something by the expected claimants on what is supposed to be paid to them? And if you say legal process, advocate, what is that? Is it anticipated that somehow in the middle of the process, these ministers will then say, we now need to downwards grade this thing? And what would it mean legally? Are you going to come up with the process of amendment in terms of it? It's not explained, so maybe it is better if you can just put the cards on the table so we know the certainty, what is the certainty of the bill, that the act that is going to come out of this process. The one third thing that I want to ask, there is something that says the scheme will be in the long term fully funded. It's not explained what exactly that means. If we can explain what that language means, in the long term. Earlier on, when the discussion ensued on the scheme, there's been a debate that took into account the sexual commission and what has been put on the table, and the whole security, social security network integration. So this clause, this language that you are suggesting, what does it mean in real term? Fully funded in long term. The board the agreement in a nutshell, that there's a concession there. At the beginning, there was ex officio status, and then agreement said, no, everybody vote. Who's then are the board members? The minister advertised for not more than 10. If you calculate the number of bodies that is going to be there, there are those who are designated by representing a minister ABC, who, as I understand this now that you are presenting, they have got a full status. The status of voting in a decision. That's where the question comes. Who makes the decision in this board? Is officials, or is the majority of them is the members who would have been invited who are not the employee of the state? Simple case. I mean, I counted six. And if you have the number of four of those who are non-state employees, then you end up with the number and the voting that will take place in the decision, because the board makes a decision based on the majority. Who then makes a decision? Is it the state or is it the board? Is it official from Treasury, Social Development, Transport, does make decision, which if you like, you would say is a decision of the board. So it takes me to the issue about the, I didn't hear very strongly this ex officio and doing away with the ex officio status of the board. And because the only reason that could be in the mind of the writer is that all of those who are in a meeting must make decisions, must be part of the decision making, and that decision will or could be a decision that's at the end of the day has got some negative. There's biasness. You say they are not employed by the state, and but designation means the board members are employed by the state. So I'm struggling to find in terms of the whole implementation, what it means. Maybe the legal brains can help us and break this down so that we understand what it means. And then there was something else that I had here, but maybe I leave this to the other members that will speak. Yes, I'll leave it there, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you.
Singer, you are the last.
Thank you, Chair, and apologies for arriving late and joining late for this meeting. Chair, I want to start with a letter that was sent out to us, the combinedly signed letter by the Ministers of Transport and Finance. And I want to pick it up from what was shared with the committee by Acting DG Slabisa on the 21st of August. I think it was prior to that, the 17th of August. On the 17th of August, the acting DG shared with us the existence of a signed letter, which alluded to the 21st of August. However, I see the date of this letter is in fact yesterday. Which just sort of triggers the question, is there another letter? Is this the only letter which you sort of foresee to be signed and that wasn't signed? And what prompted the reason for alluding to a letter which was only signed yesterday? Just clarity on, you know, whether there is another letter, whether this is the only letter, and, you know, the status of this particular letter. In that it refers to a principal agreement, and what the reference of that is, because attached to this letter were the seven elements which the Department of Transport absorbed from Treasury's recommendations. So
what is the linkage in terms of the agreement in that two ministers signed, posing a or suggesting a particular agreement? Does this agreement then reflect and acknowledge acceptance of those seven elements, or does it allude to the fact that there is a conversation about all the recommendations of Treasury and that all the recommendations have been accepted, but that only seven have at this stage been worked into the current RABS bill? And does this undertaking then of the two ministers allude to the fact that it is still in process to be absorbed in the future RABS bill, but that it's not completed yet? So you would understand that there's a lot of confusion as to the status of this agreement and whether there's another agreement, since you already on the 17th of August alluded to a particular letter, but that this letter is signed like yesterday. If you could just clarify that, and in particular the status of the attachment which was linked to this letter and the seven elements that was mentioned there and the absence of the other elements which was also part of Treasury's agreement represented by Minister Nene's signature as part of Treasury's input. So clarity around that. Then, in terms of the input from Treasury, up to this date, and also not included in this comprehensive compilation of input up to this stage, the reaction of Treasury and the reaction of the Department of Transport to the recommendations of Treasury is not part of this. I only see seven of those recommendations of Treasury being absorbed, again referring to the annexure as part of this agreement between Transport and Treasury, of which the status is due to be explained. But you might recall that I specifically interrogated and asked questions relating to the uncertainty in the modeling of the baseline cost of the Road Accident Fund, uncertainty in the modeling of the cost of RABS, uncertainty in the valuation of the income support benefits, uncertainty in the administration cost, and in general around funding. And these are still outstanding, and unfortunately I don't see any of that being part of an attempt to answer those questions. It's still outstanding. If it's still worked on, obviously one can accept that. But you might recall that there were very specific aspects which I don't see discussed anyway, like, for instance, the formulas and the reasoning and counter-argument around the use of 75% as a benefit standard opposed to what's argumented in other inputs that we have received referring to actuarial input, and also COIDA, the whole Compensation for Occupational Injuries Act, which states very clearly that this type of benefit is a post-tax benefit and 25% shouldn't be deducted from the benefit paid out to the victim, whereas you sort of insisted on the 75%. So if you could just explain, because we might run into trouble in terms of how the taxation is calculated from this. Then, Chair, in the True South report, which is now presented as part of the comprehensive compilation of input up to this stage, a very specific and strategically a very important section of tables have been left out. Table 29 and 30 that was part of the True South report and which particularly speaks to funding. And I'm very suspicious that particular table was left out because it's an important aspect around justifying and projecting future cost implications. It might be, you know, that it just slipped through because you were put under pressure since yesterday afternoon up until 4 o'clock to present this document, so I can appreciate that something might have slipped through. But then it's a crucial part of the document which I would argue should be included, since the debate around affordability is not a concluded one. In fact, it's a very unanswered one. Chair, I will stand with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Msinga. The next, once they have responded, it will be interaction one-on-one. You ask the question, they will respond. I'm sorry about that. It will be interaction. You will ask a question, they will respond so that we can not have a lot of issues hanging. But now, Mr. Sabisa, if you can, with your team, respond to the questions that have been asked.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. We want to thank the members of the committee for their available questions and their input. We will take turns and respond to the questions highlighted, points for clarity, as has been the most of this case. So we will start with our, not in order of how members have responded to the questions or posed the questions unto us. We will just take turns at this table just to go through each and every one. So we'll start from here. I will get to the issues of the letter and the dates of the letter and all that. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Acting DG. Thank you, Chairperson. Okay. I want to maybe clarify to the honorable members the following. If you look at the document that I have read into the record saying it's confirmation of agreement between the two ministers, so that we clarify in terms of what sits where, and then this will respond to indirectly to other questions that were posed by honorable ministers. We start off with the clause. If you look at how we've put the paragraphs, the current provision, that is what's set out in the bill, honorable MP, and then what follows there are comments by the National Treasury. And then the response there, it's a reflection based on comments that were made by National Treasury on the 14th. And we've taken that one in the meeting that we held as officials, and subsequent to that, the follow-up meeting between the executives. So, what to the furthest of this column is an agreement based on the inputs that National Treasury has made, and then we've incorporated them. So that is a reflection of what we did as both parties. Okay. And with regard to Clause 9, where we... And then, now we move to the question on the under the very same document, you look at the last paragraph on Clause 9, where we said the department does not agree with the suggestion and maintain the three-year term. That also is an arrival that we came down to as National Treasury and the Department of Transport. I just want to emphasize that. That it's not us not having considered what they put on the table. We resolve that, okay, based on the discussions, this is what we're going to proceed with. Because you remember, Treasury had proposed a longer period. Okay. And by the way, we'll, as 18 DGs, that we'll take turns in responding to some of these questions between myself, Mr. Willemse, and the actuary. Okay. I think Honorable Mpanza have responded to the question of your no agreement or there being agreement. And by the way, there was an issue on whether members of the board may vote. There's a, Chris, can you highlight that clause?
So the quorum requirements provided for in subsection 13(1)(a) of the current bill. So it's the majority of the voting members per board or board committee. That will, so the question has to relate, as it relates to who makes decisions in respect of the administrator. It would be the board, as informed by the majority of voting members taking a resolution. While we're on that, can I take the composition? So in respect of the composition, it does now provide for fewer members coming from the private sphere. It was 12, it's now down to 10 in terms of the proposal. It does bring into the board the CFO, which is aligned to King 4. And then you have the DGs, the ex officios. But everyone does have a vote, yes. And it's the majority of the voting members that determine, as I've indicated, a decision in respect of the administrator.
And now, thanks, Chris. Reverting back to the setup of the clauses in the very same response that we put together, because you have there 26, 27, 28, and so those, remember, the inputs that came from the National Treasury, other than the definition, they also had an issue with the financing. So if you read that, those clauses against the proposal, and then I want to, with your permission, go to each chairperson. Treasury said, they suggest that the bill must provide for separate funding, budgeting, and accounting for the administration and for the funding of benefits, including including different and appropriate budgeting and financial approval rules. These separate arrangements should be carried through into all the sections of the bill. Now, in addressing that comment, we then came up with a different set of accounts in terms of that, Honorable Member. Okay. And by the way, what will happen is when we do, there'll be a rearrangement of the clauses to tally with what will be, what's currently before us. So that will be dealt with by our Justice and Constitutional Development colleagues, the state law advisors. There was a question on the... Okay. There was a question Honourable Member raised with regard to whether it's the RAF or the bill. So I think we've responded to that as well. There was a comment that Honorable Sibandi made, and we've noted that with regard to the principal agreement. And clause was referenced to, in clause 7, you posed a question with regard to the quorum. Chris has responded to that. The issue of accounts, I've just tried to respond to that in terms of the separation. Chris, could there be anything that I might have missed in terms of that question by Honorable Sibanda?
Maybe just to add, in terms of the current position where lump sum payment is made for compensation, and where it's a represented claim, that money does get paid into a trust account for the attorney, and the interest on that account, unless a different arrangement has been made, accrues to the Law Society or the Attorney's Indemnity Insurance Fund. In terms of the new arrangement, incremental payment is made. So any interest earned on that money is retained in the account. In other words, doesn't benefit an external party. As regards the question relating to the 10,000 Rand that was initially consulted on in terms of proposed draft regulations, the current bill does not provide any fixed sum. There is no fixed sum for the funeral benefit. What is proposed in the legislation is that the minister determines from time to time that amount. And in consulting, because it was a regulation, in that consultation process, cognizance would have been taken as to the reasonability of the amount determined, cultural preferences, all of this would play into determining what that would be. There was also clarity sought in respect of the meeting between the ministers subject to obtaining the actuarial valuations. There's two decisions that must be taken from that meeting. One is if the scheme is no longer fully funded. So fully funded means that your liabilities are met with by your assets. The proposed amendment provides for a funding ratio of 90%. So the first decision that would have to be taken is if that funding ratio falls below 90%, the ministers must decide to amend legislation to either amend the benefits provided under the scheme or to increase funding through other funding streams as a possibility. Now that would require one of two things. If they amend regulations, they'll have to follow a PAJOP process. If they are required to amend the Act, they would have to come to Parliament with an amendment bill. So that's the first decision. Apart from that, the legislation also provides the current bill that there is no automatic adjustment of benefits. So there's no inflationary automatic adjustments. So from time to time, the ministers would have to, depending on the status of the scheme, adjust these benefits. And the adjustment that's contemplated there is adjusting upward. So for inflation, and it's provided for in the bill in the latter sections in section 60. But it's in concurrence between the ministers. So what has been done in the new proposal is that after the actuarial valuations have come to hand and the ministers have considered it, they will first consider the funding ratio, as is it still above 90%, in order to take appropriate action as necessary. If, let's assume it's not the case and there's enough funding in the scheme, the next question is, can they afford to increase benefits which are not per the Act self-executing in terms of adjusting for inflation? Where they do that, there's no amendment to legislation in the sense of it. They don't impact rights detrimentally. They'll publish a notice adjusting the funeral benefit is 20,000 Rand. They can upward adjust it to a new amount. Where they want to go, where they want to go back, there is a consultation process that is triggered.
Thanks, Chris. There was a question that was asked, Chairperson, by Honorable Mlauzi. The question was around whether is there a final agreement or we need a real letter. Chairperson, what's before the members is the first and final letter agreed to by the executives. Attached thereto is what we've read into the record. So there is no existence of any other letter except what is before this honorable committee. And reference was made also to the issue of the clause 9 there being disagreement. I think we've responded to that as we're addressing it based on other questions that were put by honorable members. Now, the bulk of the questions that were asked by Honorable Mlauzi were directed at the National Treasury and will chip in as and when the need arises. So may I, with your permission, request that Ms. Ulrich Britton respond to those questions?
Do so, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Honorable Members. So maybe I should go back one step and So when we were here the last time, we said there were four basic principles that we thought needed to be considered within the bill. So these were the provisions around fully funding. There were some governance matters that we thought needed to be cleared out. Given the uncertainties around the costing, maybe some flexibility should need to be built into the legislation. And the last one was on the definitions around deemed pre-accident income. And based on that, the response from the department has been around those four areas, really. So, I think we're satisfied that these have been adequately responded to by the department. So if I go to specific issues, let me first start with funding and costing and all of that. So what the bill basically provides for right now is that the current RAF levy that we have would now, so that 193 cents that we currently pay for into the Road Accident Fund, is so that levy would now go to paying for RAFs. From an accounting point of view, it means that once we move to the RAF system, that RAF liability, which is now on government's books as a contingent liability, becomes a real liability. Then it is subject to a budgeting process and a fiscal policy decision on how that is financed and paid for. So the over 200 billion rands worth of liabilities that we have is expected to be run down over a time period, and there are various financing options that we will need to be looking into to determine what the most fiscally sustainable way is of funding that. But there's in no way is the intention to that you're adding on to the existing levy to pay for the new system. It's a replacement. So the current levy will replace the existing will just be replaced from the it will move from the existing system into the new system. When we get closer to the time of having to bring this liability into the budget, it becomes a subject to a budgeting process and how we deal with this and how we finance it. So I shouldn't say subject to a budgeting process, but it is considered as part of the budgeting process on how we determine what we need to do with this liability and how what is the most effective way of dealing with it. That being said, So one of the provisions that has changed in clause 26 that makes provision for these three separate accounts creates flexibility into the system that would allow us to either appropriate money, would allow us to give some borrowing powers to the benefit account that would allow the Road Accident Fund and the Minister of Transport to go and borrow money for this and all of that. So the options that we have tabled in there is whether we can pay for this through the existing levy, whether we do appropriations, whether this is done through some loans, interest paid, and all of that gives us all the options that are available for financing either the transitional account or the benefit account. And that would then allow us to say either we take this liability onto the budget and we pay for it, or we allow the transitional account to go and borrow to pay for it, and we will either pay for it through appropriations and all of that. So we are satisfied that that flexibility around what the funding options are around the benefits, both for the old liabilities and the new liabilities, exist. What the proposal also does is it separates and has a separate accountability around the operations of the administrator. So with that, what we're doing is we're saying that the administrator must account for the salaries and the bonuses paid and office equipment and furniture and office accommodation and all of that separately from the benefits. Because by separating those accounts, what we basically do is in the annual report that is tabled in Parliament, we would have separate financial statements for each of these accounts. And we can then ask questions around, operational efficiency and all of those things. So that's what it does. And we satisfy from a governance point of view that by doing that, you're getting separate accountability for each of those. I want to talk about the board a little bit and what it does with the board. I mean, and Honorable Ramatlakhani raised an important issue around who do we want to make decisions here. So right now we have these 10 members of the board, the CEO and the CFO, that aligns with corporate governance best practices, and these nominees from the or the director generals, directors general, and or their nominees. Those nominees, so in our in the treasury's case, would always be an official of the treasury, which would make them ex officio. So if it was me who was nominated by the Director General of the National Treasury, I would be sitting on the board as ex officio, but I would still have voting rights. These are not mutually exclusive. And to answer Honorable Mpanza's question around all of this, where we have official members representing ministers or their directors general on boards, they usually have voting rights. So this isn't any different from how we the current practice that we have with entities and how their boards are structured. But there is maybe an important issue around who do we want to vote? And who do we want to ensure who makes the decisions around all of this? And how do we ensure that the officials and the CEO and the CFO doesn't outvote the other members of the board? And if there's a quorum, I mean, the quorum rules can be defined in different ways to deal with that. The lawyers are satisfied that the way it's done right now, we won't have a position where we will never be in a situation where the officials outvote the other board members. So I've dealt with that. Maybe it's important for me to confirm the issue around the term of the board, because so when we had raised the concern around all of this, honorable members will remember I said that normal boards meet 4 times a year, and they get paid for, like, in that way. And the Department of Transport has confirmed that that is not necessarily the case here. So this isn't a limitation where boards will only meet 4 times a year. Boards will meet as often as they need to meet. And given that boards will be meeting often, the time to learn and to understand the business might not necessarily be as long as it would if boards were only meeting 4 times a year. Now, an important issue around all of this is about how boards are remunerated. And if boards are remunerated per meeting or if boards are remunerated on a flat rate. Because if a board is remunerated on a flat rate, which is the undertaking that we have from the Department of Transport on all of this, then what you do is the more times the board meet, the more you get, more value you get out of them. So that would then give you, and which is why it was okay for us to say, it's fine, leave it at 3. If at 3 years, if this isn't an issue around boards only meeting quarterly. Then I'm tempted to, and this is, I'm going to take guidance from you, Acting DG, around some of the other issues that were raised around some principles in the bill around no fault and all of that, because from an economist, this is an important issue. If you're going to say that you have no fault, and that's a principle we've all accepted in the policy, it fundamentally changes behavior, and it will change road use behavior. So behavioral economics will say to us, if this was a rational person who was able to get some. So the example that you had used, Honorable Ramatlakhani, was around somebody driving, closing their eyes and driving off. But maybe they're closing their eyes and driving in and wanting to die because they have a loss of support benefit that would be paid to their children. And it might be a rational economic argument. So how do you deal with the moral hazard? And this is probably one of the sections in the bill I'm really nervous about, just from an economic behavioral point of view about what this does. And whether this compromises the policy objective. Because if it compromises the policy objective, then the policy, and if this is what we want to do, then we must accept that, you know, this is the objective here and we will deal with it. So it's a difficult thing. The lawyers say to me that the way it is right now, it doesn't compromise that policy objective. And if that's what they're saying to me from a behavioral point of view, we are okay with that. What does long-term fully funded mean? so this is again another policy objective that this thing will be fully funded. And you would you'd remember that I had said that the way it was previously written meant that the fiscus would have to respond immediately. But by putting in, inserting the benchmark that goes below that provision, what we have done is we had said that we'd always want to go back to the fully funded, is that's always the objective. But if we deviate from it, because by deviating from it and creating the 90% benchmark, what you're really doing is you're saying then we need to take whatever steps we need to take to get it back to that policy objective. Whether the benchmark is adequate, I don't know. But this is the thing about the uncertainty around all of this, and we'll get to, when we get there, we'll be able to see how often this, how often we have to do this. It might mean that we have to do this once every 3 years. It might mean that we do this once every 10 years. And I would, so Honourable Hunsinger, I'm hoping that you are okay with my initial comments around the funding and the resolution around the funding and the uncertainty in the costing and how the bill just makes flexibility to managing that. That because we don't know how to make decisions, because we don't know what kind of decisions we need, we're just going to put all of those principles in there around whether it is appropriations, whether it is through a few levy or anything else, or another levy on top of that. And I was just talking to Chris before this and saying that we really need to talk about the buoyancy of the few levy. So we might have to come back here and say that, okay, if it's done in terms of the customs and excise tax around electric cars and how do you levy a tax on electric cars or cars that are fueled by compressed natural gas. So there are, all of these are options around that that we have to think about around all of this. But we think that by putting those options in for all funding mechanisms that are available, what we're doing is we're not prohibiting or we don't need to come back to amend a piece of legislation that would allow us to make appropriations or anything like that. Okay, I think that's all from me. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thanks, Chair.
Okay.
Chair, I want to thank.
You want to continue?
No. I want to thank my colleague from National Treasury and stop there as part of our input or response to questions posed.
Thank you very much, Acting DG.
I think Chairperson, we. I think we've covered a lot of ground in terms of this and the. The issue of the letter, I think my advocates have covered it very well in terms of the date, which is now, and yet we spoke to the portfolio committee some time back. We don't engage with the portfolio committee, and then we organize and facilitate meetings between the two ministers, and we backdate the signing of the letter. I think it's quite practical and it's logic that we are going to meet as officials, we meet, at the ministers meet, and then they sign the letter when they concur with the content of the letter. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know why it should be a problem. So, but I think other than that, I think all the questions, we are very happy with the response from our colleagues from National Treasury in terms of clarifying the different accounts as to why we take so many different accounts, because we learned from our experience from the current RAF where the lawyers and the sheriff will come and take everything. They take even your seats and your chairs and your computer. So it's better to do it this way because it will be assisting us in the long run. So we're happy with that. I think we are in concurrence with the National Treasury. There's no way that we differ with National Treasury. Just wanted to say that. This letter by the ministers concurs exactly that we have met and we are in agreement. We are moving forward and we're quite happy also our colleagues from National Treasury to support us in terms of this and concur. Several meetings that we had as officials way before we engage with our ministers. I think that is quite fundamental to mention here. We want to thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, on that one, on that score. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, are there questions that have not been responded to? Let me start with Honourable Ramatlakane. Like I indicated, you will ask a question, they will respond. And I'm going to be giving you to ask a maximum of 3 questions. Honourable Ramatlakane.
That inclusive a follow-up, or there's excluding follow-up?
Start with a follow-up, and then we will go into
okay.
That.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The rules are important to understand, Chair. I'm just trying to find out the rules. No, Chair, thank you very much. Just a follow-up. The question about whether the is no fault or fault or partial. I'm not quite hearing the answer that on that question. I do hear the Treasury speaking about how do you regulate behavior and what you can do, how do you stretch for the behavioral change. And in that way, the behavioral change, and I suspect that some of the what is brought in as a kind of the one that closes the eyes, if I borrow my own term, that, and then you respond by saying, which is quite hypothetical, that they may well want to see the benefit payment. You see, the policy at the moment, which is based, this bill is based on, is a no fault. You have met. You say it is not quite no fault. We have to bring certain things into it, and as you put it, that's a behavioral management issue. So, from where I'm seated, I'm of the view that you don't make policy, you implement policy. So if the policy as given to you is X, if you can't implement it, you will have to go to policymakers and say, we're unable to, this policy has to be changed for us to be able to come up with this. I think the question that was asked by the fighter here about how are you going to determine this? How are you going to determine that this one, it was a deliberate act for an accident? Because you're going back to the to proving fault, basically. How are you going to do it? There's nothing in the bill that says this is what is going to be the parameters, the criteria to determine this. It's just a thing we're going to have to check this, whether this was not deliberate act. I haven't heard you, Mr. Williams. I haven't heard you, DG. I haven't heard you, advocate. And you're expecting us to make this law based on what you're presenting to us, but you're not giving us a detail how that's going to be measured, which I was worried about. How many times do we have to make amendment to the law based on the what you said, the legal process adjustment upwards? Now you're saying maybe 3 years, maybe 10 years. We quite don't know. We can't predict it. If economic situation goes on, then you have to sit and say, but maybe a good thing is that there's a loan. There's a loan account open there. But Treasury is also strict about that anyway. But that's the first question. I didn't hear an answer to it. This follow-up about with respect, I'm not necessarily challenging the current method of modus operandi of the board. I'm merely asking based on what has been presented. Right? You're saying all members, all these board members are going to this, and you're also saying these members are not going to be the employee of the state, but others are going to be secondees or are going to be designated. And you are saying the majority of them will make a decision. Right? So I asked the question. I think they were brought down from the number 12 to 10, isn't it? Out of the 10, how many are state officials? Because I think what we need to make a decision whether we want to make is it the board or is an extension of administrators by those who work for the state and not call them the board. Because if you're asking the majority and you nicely answer that question by not even giving an answer to it, by saying unfortunately the decision is that those, if there are four non-state and you have six, the majority is going to be six, right? And that six in this case may well be, let's say, hypothetical, because I don't know what they will think. It's those who comes from the mandate of the minister. They will make a decision based on what they are representative. So they will make that decision.
that decision, it will be seen as a board decision. That's where, that's only my issue with it. So maybe you, if you work out the voting procedures and you explain it in terms of it, maybe that will go a long way in addressing it. So let's deal with the big question. Is this no fault or a fault? We have to prove fault. Because that's where we need to do, because then we need to determine whether we're proceeding on the basis of your advice or you amend, you ask cabinet to amend the policy. I'm struggling, Chair, to make sense and logic of this argument about somebody that's going to cause accident because they want to benefit. Mr. Vellums, I'm battling with it. Yeah, maybe if you explain it, let's hear it. Because so why do we move away from the no fault? If the no fault is working, it's in fact proving fault is working currently. Why do we want policy that moves away from it? I'm just asking. Because we are going into it by stealth, nicely getting into the back of it. So in other ways, you're going to still continue to have a number of lawyers that are going to be attached to this, because now anybody who's got any must explain that how did this accident happen. It's not going to be two people. It's going to be those that are going to be involved in an accident. They must cross the bridge, and that bridge is going to be fault, prove that they are not fault. So why are we moving away from something that is in existence at the moment? That's just my question. I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, but what I'm hearing you saying, you don't say there's going to be the percentage of those who are is going to be 2%, and therefore 99% of it is no fault. They will go through like they has to go through. I don't know.
Can you respond to the lengthy follow-up? I lost track.
So even the statutory report confirms that there are no pure 100% no-fault schemes in the world. There's nothing that's absolutely no-fault. In terms of what's proposed, by far the majority of claimants, by far the majority, for them it is a no-fault scheme. You would not be required when you claim to prove fault. And the fear that you have that we would revert to what we currently have would not be the case. What is proposed is that if the administrator in adjudicating the claim establishes that you wrote a letter to your family, for instance, that said goodbye and you drove off a cliff, we will then trigger this section and say, sorry, the dependents which you wanted to benefit through your actions will not benefit. So the onus would be on the administrator to establish in certain instances criteria which would say in this instance there's enough evidence to show that this injury was caused intentionally. For the rest of the claimants, as they lodge and get processed, this wouldn't be wouldn't create the challenge that you anticipate in respect of attorneys. It would not. As regards to the nature of the scheme, the preamble refers to no fault. That's correct. The object of the bill in Section 2 does not. And in Section 29, which creates its liability-creating clause, does qualify that clause with the introductory word subject to the Act. So I don't know if I answered you.
Mr. Vellum, sir, let's allow the acting DG to come in.
Honorable Chairperson, I think the migration from the fault base to a no-fault base is the same journey we are going through. I think that one we should not have any ambiguity on that one. I think I just wanted to put that one clear up front. We do not want the scheme as it is now, which is the road accident fund. We want to migrate from the road accident fund to the no-fault base, which is the RAPS bill. That's I think that's what we must clear in our minds. what is written here, as we are presenting to the Portfolio Committee to Parliament today, is to enrich this bill so that by the time it becomes an act, it becomes a true a no-fault base for the public or the road users. So if ever, Honorable Chairperson, the writing here, the comments, would suggest that someone will go and close the eyes and go to the opposite direction and get in under the truck or the bus and die, I think it's very painful to die in an accident. In fact, I've visited quite a number of incidents, road crashes. Those people, when you look at them, when they are, I think it's very difficult to go and visit a scene. You don't sleep in the night. You don't sleep. It's so devastating to see a body that you don't see the head of somebody lying somewhere, the arm somewhere else, and so forth and so forth. Then you subject yourself to such a kind of a gruesome death. I mean, it's quite a serious matter to sort of involve yourself into such a kind of a thing. For me, I would say if this one will cause the bill to be read as partial, let's deal with the clause as such, so that it does not create that kind of an ambiguity. So for me, that is what would be guided by the legislators, so that we deal with the matter, so that we don't want to find ourselves the bill being not going through because of partial and no fault. We are very clear on this. We do not want to see the road accident fund as a fund as it stands now, because it's not benefiting the people, but it benefits those lawyers and those people, like Honorable Sibande was saying. The money goes somewhere else instead of to the beneficiaries who are the victims of road crashes. But what we would like to see, this one, no fault, we deal with that. So if it has got an element of a fault to be proved, let's deal with that clause and that subject in terms of this bill, this proposed bill, so that we are all on the same page on the matter. So that is what I would suggest, Chairman, so that there is no ambiguity. So I hear the notion around it in terms of what is it? Is it? I think from the House, it's a no-fault base. We are migrating from the Road Accident Fund as it stands, because it's not benefiting. The larger majority of the people who get maimed on our road network. So that is what I wanted just to clarify, Chairperson, so that we can all be on the same page.
State law advisor, legal advisor from Parliament, what is your take? Nolitando, let me start with him. How do you advise members?
Chair, I think there was one question that was directed to the legal advisors. It was by Leonard, Mr. Ramatlakane, the one that deals with the board members, the CEO and the CFO being voting members of the board. Chairperson, I quickly had a look at the PFMA, Section 49, which deals with accounting authorities. And then it says when there is a board of a public entity, then the board becomes the accounting authority. And if there's a CEO and there's no board, then the CEO becomes the accounting authority. So now in this case, if the CFO and the board both have voting powers, who will be the accounting authority? And also, Chairperson, the board, its role has to be independent, and then it governs the public entity, and the CEO manages the public entity. So the CEO would take, as the proposal stands, the CEO would take a decision about the scheme, and then take it to the board. And then the CEO would be voting for his decision or against his decision. It just doesn't sit well with me in terms of corporate governance and the independence of the board and the role that both the CEO and the board has in terms of the PFMA and in terms of corporate governance. Thank you, Chairperson.
you don't want to enter the fray of fault, partial fault, no fault.
I'd rather not, Chairperson. Thank you.
State law advisor.
Good afternoon.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chairperson, the MPs, the committee as a whole. I think on the basis of the board, we will, as with the department, and look at that provision in the PFMA and try to redraft it in a proper way. Regarding to fault or no fault, Chairperson, is the policy issue. So, thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. It's a policy issue. Can the drafters put this in the parking bay? We'll come back to it. Alma, we still have to come back to it. Ramatlakana, a matter of 3 minutes, three questions if you can, or 3 minutes, one question.
Okay, I'm just saying perhaps in this current discussion, and I'm looking at the acting DG, perhaps we should take I would like to maybe leave my follow-up, because I was troubled, seriously troubled, by Mr. Bellums's response. And what troubled me is what we are dealing with, and whether we are, our head is in the bag. Because he started off by saying there is nothing in the world like. When the policy was adopted by cabinet, said something else. And I think the DG brings us back to the policy, because I thought then we are nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. So I would let go on my follow up on that issue, rather take that view of the DG in looking at the clauses that we have to align it. And I think the lawyers also advise us that it has to be looked at. So I will let go on the 2 points that I was going to make follow-up on. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singer. You fine? Honorable Sibande?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like to be clarified maybe in one or two things. Number one, I think is the thing which you are just clarifying, because I'm the person who started the issue of no fault. That I was happy that my colleague just go broad. The issue, therefore, yes, the question still pending about the issue of investigations and powers. Those who will be doing the job, you know, because with that one, I want to comment something. Please, I'm totally against with the thing whereby when we start some of these laws and we make a loophole, only to find that as the time goes on, some people, they do take this task and give them to the consultants. At the end, the job is done by the consultants. It's not done by the department itself. That's why, therefore, if you can please take us on board about the issue of investigations and powers. And then also, you see, in terms of funding and costing, I think there was an element in Alibu Treasury which was left. I don't know, maybe it's part of my mind, I don't know. The issue of fuel levy. How is it, is it going to be affected or not? Because previously, some of the people, in particular, when you're doing the presentation, it was perceived as if fuel consumption is going to be affected drastically. Now, since there was this mutual agreement, may you please take us on board? How did you, discuss that matter of fuel levy? And then I think also, yeah, but you covered the thing of compliance and key legislations, because a lot of people, because what my concern also, we let us, when we do this exercise, check the loopholes about the issue of legislation with the compliance. in terms of with key legislations. Once we do that, I don't see anything which is going to challenge us on that, in that regard. Because I think part of clause number 26 was part of the key challenge in terms of legality and compliance, because it was regarded as if it's not complying with what we wanted to draft. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Can we get response to what Honorable Sibande has just said?
As regards investigation powers, the bill provides in Section 44 for access to information provisions so the administrator could request and obtain records in relation to motor vehicle accident victims. In addition to that, Section 45 provides power to subpoena persons and documents in order to provide the administrator with the necessary information to assess a claim.
Chairperson, there was also a question posed about the fuel levy. I'll request my colleague from National Treasury to respond to that. Thank you.
Okay, so the conversations that we've had around the fuel levy has been around the level of the current fuel levy versus the cost of the system. And what the clauses currently do is it allows that if there is So 186 cents is the cost of the system versus the 193 cents. So what we're able to do is we're able to take that 6 cents a litre, and what the bill currently provides for right now is for us to then move that 6 cents into the RAF to pay for the liabilities there. But I suppose, I mean, there is a longer-term issue around the fuel levy. As you're all aware, we're having a conversation around possible reductions in the fuel levy and what that may mean. But the fuel levy, so and I don't want to get this into other conversations because we talk about this when we get to Tolstoy and all of that. So the fuel levy itself is not a buoyant revenue stream, so in the long term. So, and these are because of technological changes that we're seeing right now. So what are the things that we see with the fuel levy currently is that cars become more fuel efficient. So per kilometer travel, they use less and less fuel. So for the same amount of travel, they are buying less fuel. And by buying less fuel, we're getting less revenue in from the fuel levy because that is charged per liter. And given these other options, and this isn't a conversation that we have had yet. I mean, it's still some, and I think even within the Treasury, this is a conversation we need to have with the tax policy unit around what are those alternatives that allows us to effectively charge road users to pay for this, because that was the principle around with that we, in the one place where we have deviated from the Satchel Commission's recommendations in the policy was that people who contribute to the system shouldn't be unfairly prejudiced by still having this being open to this potentially large liability. And what this does is then saying is, how do we get everybody, all road users, to contribute to the system? And what are those mechanisms? And is the fuel levy still the most appropriate way to do this? For the medium term, yes, it is. But there, we are going to have conversations quite soon, given alternatives around, I mean, I just saw something about hydrogen fuel in that, if for cars, electricity, solar-driven cars, compressed natural gas and all of that. And then when we get to, and I mean, this is a policy conversation that we will need to have in the near term around how do we then bring that back into the system to ensure all road users pay for this, so we don't compromise the efficacy of the system and some of the principles within the policy objectives to manage this.
Honorable Siabi.
Thanks, Chair. I guess my question on clause 7 about 1B and 1C above possibly will be attended to when we draft, because it was not answered that 1B above refers to the CFO. Is that the correct capturing? Or or 1B above, you wanted to refer to the 10 members so that we are clear. But second teacher, on the appointment, and you'll pardon me for my late coming, the minister appoints the board. The minister appoints the chairperson and the deputy chairperson, and the minister appoints the CEO. And I'm asking this question in the context of the SABC ruling that the minister should not interfere in the appointments of staff. As it is captured here, is it good practice in the context of the SABC ruling? Thanks, Chair.
Can we get the responses?
Chairperson, thank you for that. Thanks, Honourable Member. You're correct. It's just a question of redrafting. It should be 1C in actual fact, not 1B. So the state law advisors will attend to that. Sorry, we might have missed that.
Can I follow up? Can you repeat your question? It looks like they didn't hear.
Now, I'm saying the bill provides for the minister to appoint the board, the minister to appoint the chairperson and the deputy chairperson, and the minister to appoint the CEO, even if it says after recommendation of the board. Is it good practice in the context of the SABC ruling that says the minister should not interfere with the appointments of staff that should be left to the board?
Okay.
Yes, well, it is a governance issue, Chairperson, but then this is the current position. Hence, you said it's a question of redrafting. We'll try to put that right.
We're also wanting to say the comment the oral member is making is quite understood, because we're trying to follow what the ruling was. Yes. So we want, therefore, to be in line with the ruling of the court, because it's become law. So we want to see how this will be, therefore, working with our state law advisors to redraft it so that it doesn't become 1B further down there, but it can come up under the appointment of the CEO and the CFO. So that is what Makgato is talking about in terms of redrafting this law. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Honorable Mpanza.
No, thank you, Chair. Chair, I just wanted to emphasize the fact that we should avoid ambiguity in all what we are saying, because I think now we want to move forward and know. So if the issue of the no fault is a policy, so then let's stick to the policy. And I think that let's not even debate it and then become an issue going forward. But also, if the issue of the officials in the form of senior, of the CEO, and I can't understand the ex-officio, but also voting. So let's just be clear and say it's ex-officio or it's voting. But you can't have two. Yeah, we don't have a hybrid kind of an arrangement. So that's what I'm saying. let's just be clear. Policy, ex-officio or no ex-officio. And then the issue of the quorum, I don't know, Chair. They again talks about the majority. But there is a trend that is followed in most of the organizations, you become specific. 50 plus 1. Is there a problem if it's just specific like that? It doesn't say the majority, because the majority might be 7 out of 10, might be 8, might be 6. So I'm just dealing with this ambiguity things, but it's fine. Chair, the last one is the issue of the 3-year term and the flat rate, and then the unlimited meetings. That's also a problem, Chair. Most of the boards have collapsed because of that, because then it become an activity-based board and a money-making exercise for board members, even if it's a flat rate. But I think there must be a ceiling of some kind, even if you don't confine yourself to a four-term meeting. But let's come up with some number of meetings, because then they will see it every month and every week. And then at the end of the day, they are not effective, they are not efficient, because it's just meetings. So I'm just raising that one. Can they look at those issues, Chair, and get it and answer that?
Thank you. Can we get response?
Thanks, Chairperson. Accepted that at all costs we should avoid ambiguity. It's accepted, Honourable Member. It's something that we'll also work into, whether we say should it be 50 plus 1 or just that we are clear on that. I think the comments are noted, and then it's something that we'll work through with the State Law Advisors. Those are.
Honourable Msinga.
Thank you, Chair. While we have Treasury here, just a question to Treasury. Looking at the operational side of how RAPS is envisaged to function, you would need the cooperation of at least 4 other departments, in particular health, and with a huge cost implication for health. Is the health department of health, are they aware of what's coming their way? And in terms of providing infrastructure requirements as described in terms of the assistance and benefit construction, have you undertaken any conversation with the Department of Health and made an assessment of what's available and what could be provided and what should be provided in terms of the benefit scope and spectrum of this bill?
Can you respond?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think this question is actually misdirected, because it's something the Department of Transport should be doing. But we have major reforms coming in the health. No, but I mean, there are cost implications. But what we're also seeing is major reforms within the health sector. And what we need to do is ensure that what we're trying to do here aligns with the reforms that we are seeing within the health sector. And that there's alignment between the NHI bill that is out right now for public comment and what we are trying to do here, so that we don't miss each other around that. Thank you.
You want and to take... Oh.
Yes, I just want to... Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to bring to the Honourable MP's attention. If you look at the memorandum of objects of the bill, Chairperson, under paragraph 4.4, and I'm going to read from it. It's titled Parties Consulted. The Department of Transport also consulted with the Department of Home Affairs, Department of Health, Department of Social Development, Department of Labor, and the National Treasury. So the answer to that question is in the affirmative.
Thank you very much. Are there still takers from here? The next engagement, if there's none from honourable members, The document that we are having, we went to the back of the document so that we are able to deal with the issues, and then we are able to, at some stage, can release functionaries from Treasury. I'm going to request the acting DG to take us through. We will work through these responses with respect to the consultations that were done, and we will stop somewhere, and we'll continue again on Friday until we're able to finish this. So basically, we had to deal with this so that we can be able to get concurrence with Treasury and then go back to what we were supposed to do. Acting DG, are you ready?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. We would like to talk to the document as was circulated to the members, starting from all what we said since we started the discussion with on this bill, coming from all the way from people who have been consulted, and what are the responses, the comments from them, and just to take us through so that take you through so that you can have a feel of what has been happening since we started the consultation on this bill. So we would like therefore to ask our colleagues, the two advocates here, to take us through this from page one of this document until we go to the last page, which is page 30 of the document. So we'll go through quickly, fairly quickly. We want to believe that members have read the document. If ever there are issues that you needed to highlight as we go through the document, we will stop and clarify some issues. Can I request that Advocate Makgato take us through the comments and the responses? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Acting DG. Chairperson, again, referring to the entire document that we put together and submitted to this committee, from page 1 up until page 30, as the DG said, captures the responses that we've put together to date based on the public hearings. I'll call them Cape Town public hearings, what we went out on, submissions by the National Treasury and the legal professions, your LSA, CEO of this world, and so forth, from our consultations with them. So I'm not going to go through the entire document, but then this first, the 29 pages that before you, Chairperson, because they capture everything, okay? In the preamble, National Treasury requested that a statement, the comment, National Treasury requested that a statement must be made for the scheme to be fully funded in the long term. Now, our response is a proposal is made to align the fully funded requirement to a funding ratio of 90%. Then, because we've now added a new definition under Clause 1, Treasury required clarity in respect of the definition. We are providing a definition there of what would constitute average annual national income. I'm not going to read that because I've gone through it earlier on for the sake of brevity. And then we do a clause-by-clause comment in terms of the inputs that came. The provision of the clause 2A, objects, the provisions of the bill are not reasonable, affordable, and sustainable and equitable. The objectives of the bill mirror the commission report objectives and the definitions as referred to in that report. The bill proposes a system that is reasonable in that it acknowledged the symbiotic relationship of the road accident compensation with the broader system of social security and its objectives. For example, the number of persons covered is increased by up to 40%, and the age limits are set where other social security benefits become available. The bill proposes an affordable system of road accident compensation, which will be within the financial means of road users and South African society as a whole.
As indicated earlier, a 20% saving is anticipated with up to 40% more persons receiving cover. The bill proposes a system that is efficient in its accessibility and administration, that is facilitative of health care and rehabilitation, and that alleviates financial hardship and anxiety, more especially at the lower income levels. The bill proposes a system that will be equitable in that there will be proportionality between the funding of the system and the demands made thereon. We're going to say the following. RAF is a fair, equitable, and reasonable and affordable compensation system, not according to the findings of the central report referred to earlier. The fault requirement and the requirement to prove a loss exclude many accident victims and their dependents who contribute to the RAF fuel levy. The poor contribute at the same rate as the rich, but recover proportionately much less, thereby subsidizing the rich. This is not fair, equitable, or reasonable. The RAF revenue expenditure are not matched. Claims liability provision increased by 22% from 154 to 188 billion in the 2016-17 financial year, and by 14% to 215 billion in the 2017-18 financial year. These are unaudited. The RAF fuel levy is 193 cents per liter of fuel sold, producing an income of approximately 3 billion per month in the 2017-18 financial year. The recent 30 cents increase is only expected to start flowing in from July, August. Claims of approximately 3.3 billion are settled per month in the 2017-18 financial year. Payments in excess of the 9.3 billion to over 3,900 creditors are outstanding as at 11 May 2018. Because of the cash flow constraints, thousands of writs are served on the RAF each year. Furniture, computers, and other assets are regularly attached by creditors and sold in execution. And the RAF bank accounts are attached, resulting in the disruption of operations and claims processing and payments. Legal fees and disbursements paid of 7.5 billion in the 2016-17 financial year and 8.3 billion in the 2017-18 financial year. These figures remain unaudited, so you'll see there's an increase. Which fees are in addition to the balance of contingency fees and other disbursements not recovered from the RAF? A vast number of victims will not have funds to pay an attorney to assist them with their claim. These victims will not be aware of their rights and prescription periods. The RAF currently already assists close to one in three claimants to claim. Unlike the RAF, the proposed scheme will provide defined benefits on a no-fault basis. Room for legal dispute are consequently massively reduced. Why would an attorney be required, more especially since the administrator is A, obliged in terms of Section 5A to assist claimants, B, obliged in terms of subsection 6, Roman figure 1 and 3, to create public awareness on the bill, which includes awareness in respect of the obligation to assist as envisaged in Section 5A. C, able to contract with contracted healthcare providers appointed per Section 31, which contracted healthcare providers will also serve as points of origination for claims by victims who seek treatment. D, empowered in terms of Section 45 to access information from numerous sources to identify potential claimants, source data, and to render such assistance. E, obliged in terms of Section 31K to pay the claimant's medical reports cost related to the claim.
The comment seems to suggest that a common law fault-based system where attorneys are active results in the victims being more aware of their rights. So claims will not, so claims do not prescribe. Why would this be? Might this be because of referrals by thousands of accident victims to attorneys for a fee? Court and UIF has built up reserves because claimants are not assisted by attorneys. The same will happen under RAPS, where attorneys will not be present to hold it accountable as with RAF. Why are attorneys not holding Quiet and UIF accountable? The legislation does not exclude attorneys, so why are attorneys only holding the RAF accountable? Okay. The difference seems to lie in the 25% contingency fee plus disbursements which attorney can recover from the claimant's damages paid by the RAF as a lump sum. RAPS will make structured payments as opposed to lump sum payments, and there are no general damages awards from which attorneys will be able to recover the type of fees which they currently recover under the RAF dispensation. Comment: RAF can be better managed by using one expert and by settling claims long before a trial date is allocated. In as far as is practical, the RAF already requires its claim handlers to attempt to agree with the plaintiff attorney to use a single expert. As regards earlier settlement and the practice by plaintiff's attorneys in the judgment of Motswai versus Road Accident Fund 2014 JOL 3229, the SCA, a senior plaintiff attorney gave evidence to the Supreme Court as follows. Quote, in regard to the procurement of medical reports by the plaintiff's attorney, Mr. Crano says that the procedure he adopts is to obtain the reports after the close of pleadings and once a trial date has been allocated. And even though they endeavor to obtain reports some months before the trial, it is often practically difficult to do so because examinations and assessments have to be booked far in advance. Two significant points can be distilled from the above. Firstly, that the plaintiff's attorney waited until the statutory 120 days to serve summons, then for a trial date, and only takes steps to assess the quantum of the claim through obtaining medical expert reports. Secondly, that it is particularly difficult to get an appointment with an expert. The same would apply to the RAF. In its comments to the Rules Board for Courts of Law in relation to proposed amendments to the rules that govern expert notices and reports, Adams and Adams attorneys, amongst others, provided the following comment. In some instances, injuries sustained may take 18 to 14 months to stabilize. A period of 12 months is required to brief experts and to adequately prepare for a trial, failing which the matter will not be ripe for hearing thereof. Where the experts involved identify further medical issues that require the input of additional experts or addendum reports from experts, it is not easy to obtain appointments for the patients. Since most expert diaries are booked fully in advance for anything from 6 to 12 months, if not more, a plaintiff would be required, in terms of the proposed amendment to the rules, to do a large amount of work and have the expert reports prior to issuing summonses, thereby resulting in pre-litigation costs being incurred and not being recoverable by the plaintiff on the party and party scale. Should the party ultimately succeed in the action, the medical reports obtained prior to summons will be outdated by the hearing date, resulting in an addendum report and additional costs. Close quotes. The above inputs highlight the practice by plaintiff's attorney to only really prepare to settle a claim after summons has been served closer to the trial date. In Daniel and others versus the RAF and others, 2011 JOL 27218 WCC, the duty placed on the RAF to settle claims is described as follows. I quote, "It is evident upon a consideration of aforementioned provisions of the Act that the compensation scheme provided thereby contemplates that a claimant will, when submitting a claim, provide the fund with sufficient relevant information to enable it to, one, investigate whether it is liable, in other words, whether the insured driver was casually at fault in regard to the injuries or death upon which the claim is founded, and if so, to also determine the amount of compensation payable. The interval of 120 days that is required to pass between the filing of a claim and the accrual of a right to the claimant to institute action against the fund to enforce payment of a claim for compensation is obviously intended to permit the fund sufficient opportunity to carry out the required investigations, and if indicated, to settle the claim or attempt to settle it before the institution of litigation." Close quotes. The practice by attorneys is to prepare claim for trial, not to submit a complete claim to the RAF to settle earlier. In this regard, it is worth noting that an attorney would settle a claim within 120-day period will write considerably less fees than an attorney who settles the claim after a trial date has been allocated. Another comment, a dual system of no fault coupled with an opt-out option for the fault-based common law claim is proposed, coupled with private liability insurance mandated by the bill. The proposal runs contrary to the guidance already provided by the Constitutional Court referred to above. Quote, "The colossal risk to which the new cap exposes all drivers, from which the fund would previously have protected them by paying full compensation, as against the relatively small attentiveness or oversight that could give rise to the risk, lends further support to the abolition of the common law action. What is more, the retention of the common law claim does not sit well with the social security compensation system that aims to provide equitable compensation, as distinct from the right to sue for compensation for all people regardless of their financial ability." Was a comment made on clause 5E and 31. "The facilitation by the administrator of healthcare through contracted service providers will lead to inferior, quote, cheap, close quote, services to the detriment of the injured." Section 217 of the Constitution mandates the procurement of services by all organs of state through a process that is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. The bill explicitly provides for this process in Section 31. If this comment is to be accepted, it implies that the Constitution mandates the delivery of state of inferior services, which is clearly not the case. Consider the example of a generic medicine and brand name medicine. The active ingredients in both medicines are the same, but the latter cost significantly more. Per the argument put forward, the scheme must incur the additional cost for no additional benefit, resulting in an unnecessary waste which will have to be carried by motorists who ultimately fund the scheme. The National Treasury proposed amendment to the composition and voting rights of the board. Chairperson, I'm not going to go through this because we've already done that. So it's 16.2. 26. Up until 26, and then I go to 27.1, which is at page 11. The exclusion related to terrorist activity is not rational since there is no sus rea insurance for this. The mischief sought to be addressed by the bill is damage caused in relation to the driving, open brackets, in the normal course, close brackets, of motor vehicles, not damage caused by terrorist activity. The section comment, the section must be amended to clearly provide for the exclusion of claims based on product liability, if that is the intention. The current exclusion only relates to the driver, owner, and employer. The mischief sought to be addressed by the bill is damage caused in relation to the driving,
open brackets, in the normal course, close brackets, of motor vehicles, not damage caused because of product liability. Consequently, the following amendment of subsection 27(1) is proposed. The administrator shall not be liable to provide a benefit, nor is the liability of any person excluded in respect of A, bodily injury or death caused by or arising from the use of a motor vehicle to perpetrate any terrorist activity as defined in the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist and Related Activities Act of 2004. And the insertion there, or a bodily injury or death caused by or arising from the use of a vehicle in circumstances where the producer or importer, distributor, or retailer is liable for the harm in terms of Section 61 of the Consumer Protection Act. Comment, the bill does not exclude benefits in respect of criminals and claimants who intentionally injure themselves, and Home Affairs processes may impact claims on foreigners. We are suggesting the following reformulation of Clause 27(4). The liability of the administrator is limited to payment for the provision of emergency health care service if the injured person is not a citizen or permanent resident of the Republic or the holder of a valid permit or visa issued in terms of the Immigration Act of 2000 or the Refugees Act of 98. B, the claimant or beneficiary drove the vehicle or was conveyed in or on. Chairperson, I'm reminded that we dealt with this, so I'm not going to bore you with that detail. Can I skip to 27(4)? My apologies. The comment there is everyone in the country is guaranteed the right in the Bill of Rights, therefore the exclusion is unconstitutional. In the COSA and others versus Minister of Social Development and others, Masaule and another versus Minister of Social Development and others, 2005, JOL 12540, it's a constitutional court decision. The court stated, I accept that the concern that non-citizens may become a financial burden on the country is a legitimate one, and I accept that there are compelling reasons why social benefits should not be made available to all who are in South Africa, irrespective of their immigration status. We are therefore making a comparative legal study with Botswana, and Chairperson, I'm not going to read that, also with Swaziland, Namibia. These were part of the comments that we made on the 6th of the 6 months, if I recall well, in Parliament. Clause 28. Contrary to sexual commission, the right to claim the balance of damages not covered from the scheme has been removed. Failure to have the common law claim restored will render the scheme vulnerable to constitutional attack. The Constitutional Court has already ruled on the removal of the common law claim, Chairperson. Asylum seekers, the comment, asylum seekers, refugees and migrant workers have difficulties to obtain and extend permits due to logistical and other reasons not of their making, which may result in their exclusion under the scheme. The subsection must be deleted or amended. This concern is for the Department of Home Affairs to address. It would be inappropriate to legislate for these concerns in the bill based on the alleged inefficiencies which, if later resolved, result in an unintended additional liability for the scheme. However, if the committee agrees to make allowance in the bill, the following revision is proposed. If an injured person or deceased breadwinner is not a citizen or permanent resident of the Republic or the holder of a valid permit or a visa issued in terms of the Immigration Act or Refugees Act, The liability of the administrator is limited to payment for the provision of emergency health care services, provided to such injured person or deceased breadwinner while he or she was alive. Clause 29, comment, contrary to sexual commission, no life enhancement benefits are provided. This comment is accurate. The proposed scheme increases access, number of accident victims assisted by almost 40%, close brackets, and by reducing benefits which were recoverable under the RAF, and amongst others, excludes general damages, open brackets, or the so-called lifestyle benefits, which the proposed scheme cannot afford. We quote a paragraph from the Sexual Commission report, and it reads as follows. It is inappropriate for a road accident benefit scheme funded by the taxpayer and regulated by the state to award general damages, which is the heritage of common law of delict and is a concept alien to principles of comprehensive social protection and a scheme of limited social security benefits. It appears that the only real merit in awarding the compensation for pain and suffering or loss of amenities and enjoyment of life is to provide victims who have sustained catastrophic injuries and or life-changing impairment with finances which provides for lifestyle changes and leisure pursuits. That's our emphasis. In a way which cannot be expected of a road accident benefit scheme. For this reason, any such benefit should be known as, quote, life enhancement benefits, close quote. Chairperson, there were comments on clauses 31, 32, and 33, and we dealt with them like that. The comment was, with regards to severe injuries, the 18-year and 60-year limitation on the benefits must be clarified. An injured, Chairperson, with regard to whether or not is a minor, regardless of whether it is a minor, moderate, or severe injury, the person will be entitled to medical benefit immediately after the injury for as long as it is necessary until death. Another comment was the administrator may refuse purely palliative care. A World Health Organization defines palliative care as follows. Palliative care is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problem associated with life-threatening illness. Through the prevention and relief of suffering by means of an early identification and impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, physical, physiosocial, and spiritual. The bill defines, quote, bodily injury as including physical and psychological injuries. The medical benefit comprises of reasonable health services for treatment and care and rehabilitation and includes rehabilitative care, long-term personal care, and provision for assistive device, structural changes to homes, vehicle, and the workplace. Consequently, reasonable palliative care is available within the available medical benefit. Unreasonable requests to be considered on the merits must be refused, as it is the case with any other type of unreasonable treatment request. The process to claim a medical benefit, forms and pre-authorization, is cumbersome. The use of forms and pre-authorizations are necessary controls to manage expenditure. These controls are and have been for many years firmly entrenched in the medical scheme industry. RABS will similarly use the same controls to manage access to benefits. An accident victim that uses the services of a contracted healthcare service provider will not incur any liability or co-payment, so no claim will arise. The contracted healthcare service provider will submit a claim in respect of the healthcare services provided to the accident victim to RABS, which claim will be based on the contractual arrangement and the processes agreed to with RABS. The prescribed forms will likely not form part of these processes as provided for in subsection 42.2 of the bill. Where the medical services was provided by a non-contracted healthcare service provider, the completion of forms will be required. pre-authorization will not be required if A, the healthcare service is urgently required in an emergency situation in order to preserve the injured person's life or the bodily functions, or where treatment cannot be delayed. B, if in the opinion of the medical practitioner who has personally examined the injured person, the injured person's medical condition would subject to the injured person to severe pain that cannot be adequately managed without immediate medical intervention, or C, if the healthcare service is already authorized in accordance with an individual treatment and rehabilitation plan or vocational training program. Another comment, RABS may require a beneficiary to be assessed for purposes of preparing the treatment and rehabilitation plan at the beneficiary's cost. This comment is inaccurate. The bill is clear in this respect and reads as follows, 33.2. For the purposes of preparing an individual treatment or rehabilitation plan, the administrator may require a beneficiary to be assessed by a healthcare service provider at the cost of the administrator. Comment, once the treatment and rehabilitation plan has been agreed, the beneficiary is no longer free to choose a medical practitioner or institution of his choosing. This comment is inaccurate, noting that the beneficiary, his curator, employer or future employer, and existing or future medical service providers would have participated in the development of the plan. It is likely that agreed plans will contain provisions to allow for a review of the plan if the beneficiary's circumstances change. Comment was, rehabilitation centers are scarce and far from rural areas. The medical benefit provides for transport costs necessary to receive any health care service, which includes rehabilitation. Comments were made with regard to clauses 34, 35, 36, and 38. They related to income and family support benefits. The LSSA interprets the deeming provision relating to ordinary residents to apply to citizens and permanent residents only. The LSSA's interpretation is incorrect. All citizens and permanent residents qualify for temporary income and support and long-term income support regardless of the deeming provision relating to residents. Conversely, only citizens and non-permanent residents are impacted by the deeming provision relating to residents. The position is the same with regards to dependents who are citizens or permanent residents. They will qualify for family support benefits regardless of the deeming provision relating to ordinary residents. Income illegally earned will be excluded. What is considered illegal will give rise to debate. Two examples postulated in the verbal submission was unlicensed panel beater and a hawker. That's a comment, and our response thereto is, what constitutes, quote, illegal income, close quotes, is already well recognized in our case law. For example, Santam Insurance versus Ferguson, 1985, 2 All SA, page 591. Quote, an unlicensed panel beating business, Dominion Another versus Protea Insurance Company Limited, 1974, All SA, 678, it's an appellate decision. A person who earned an illegal income is not without a claim. The claim will, however, be based on the average annual national income. The average annual national income benefit does not allow for residual income, which is higher. Example of two medical students who complete studies but miss the road accident before starting employment used to illustrate the impact under RAF versus RAPS. The RAF Act caps income claims at 270,285 as at April 2018 per annum. It is likely that the upper income cap under the RAPS will track the above RAF Act cap. In the LSSA's example, student A injured prior to the implementation of RAPS would be covered by RAF and would be able to claim loss of income based on his earning potential, as opposed to actual earnings
limited to 270,285 per year. Student B, injured after the implementation of RAPS, would not be covered by RAF and would be limited to a temporary income support benefit and or a long-term income support benefit calculated on the annual national average income, which is 52,527 as at December 31, 2016. If only the benefits, open brackets, not fault, close brackets, are compared, student A is better off than student B. But what about the fundamental difference between RAF and RAPS fault? A fair comparison must also consider the impact that fault may have on the respective benefits. If one assumes a range of percentages or contributory negligence, that is fault, on the part of both student A and B, comparison between the RAF and RAPS changes. There's a table there with the percentages and numbers there, Chairperson. I'm not going to read to that. But then continue to say that not everyone is fortunate to earn the salary of a doctor. 87% of the population are unemployed or earn up to the 72,000 rands income tax bracket. If one changes the income assumption of the claimant of claimant A to 72,000 brackets, the open brackets, the upper limit of taxable earning of 87% of the population, a different picture appears. And I'm not going to read that, Chairperson. Comment, age limits are unreasonable. 60-day waiting period, temporary income support, age limit of 18, income support, age limit of 18, family support, age limit of 60, income and family support. Under the RAF system, no provision is made for statutory waiting periods or statutory age limits, and each claimant is free to prove the period of actual loss in accordance with the applicable delictual principles. The claimant's proven actual loss is then reduced in respect of collateral benefits, e.g. quiet payments, but excluding benefits that are res inter alios acta, benevolent payment, for example, benevolent payments. Contingencies, pre and post contingencies are deducted. Example, uncertainties relating to employment. Apportionment of fault, that's in terms of the Apportionment of Damages Act. Statutory caps are applied, the 270,285 as at April 2018 per annum. The lump sum payments are then capitalized to reflect the present day value of loss. In the RAF system, it is possible to receive no compensation, that is, nothing for medical treatment, nothing for loss of income, nothing for loss of support, and nothing for general damages. The RAF system therefore provides full security for those contributing to the fuel levy. Now compare that with the RAP system. This bill is not based on delictual principles. It doesn't seek to compensate each individual to the extent of his or her proven loss. Instead, the bill prioritizes need over loss and seeks to provide for a minimum social security safety net, also taking into account other social security benefits available to road crash victims. The age limits are necessary for the scheme to be A, reasonable. It must acknowledge the symbiotic relationship of road accident compensation with the broader system of social security and its objectives. B, be affordable. It must, quote, be within the financial means of road users and South African society as a whole, close quote. C, sustainable, that there must be a reinforcement of the broader system of social security, which in turn should be supportive of road accident compensation. D, it must be equitable in that there must be a proportionality between the funding of the system and the demands made thereon. There should be some balance or congruence between the benefits made available to road accident victims and the benefits made available to other South Africans in need. Close quote. Unlike the RAF, the proven actual loss is not compensated. Instead, defined benefits are provided.
Unlike the RAF, the defined benefits are not reduced for collateral benefits, contingencies, or fault. Unlike the RAF, full medical and rehabilitation benefits are available for as long as required, regardless of fault. There was a comment made with regard to the schedule. The 75% multiplier used in the formula possibly amounts to a double taxation. The multiplier has nothing to do with taxation as the benefit is already calculated on after tax income. The Statutory Commission recommended the use of a multiplier which recommendation has been taken up in the bill. Some of the reasons for the use of a multiplier are A, it is not appropriate that a safety net provided for by the scheme must provide full reimbursement. B, someone in employment incurs greater expenses than someone who remains out of their workforce. And C, the multiplier may create a financial incentive to return to work. Another comment, not allowing for inflationary adjustment will diminish benefits in real terms, further significantly disadvantaging beneficiaries in relation to other claimants who claim in relation to other types of delicts. For the system to remain affordable, levers are necessary to manage liability. Where the income of the scheme does not track inflation, it will not be affordable for the benefits to do so. Another comment, the income support benefit ceases upon the death of the beneficiary, which, if the death is unrelated to the road crash, will mean that no provision is made for the future support of the dependents. The benefits provided for by RABS are provided in relation to injuries or death arising from motor vehicle accidents, not other causes. If the death is related to the road crash, the dependents have access to their individual family support benefits. Comment, under the current system, a lump sum is paid which could be used to make provision for financial security of the family. If the death is unrelated to road crash and as a result of a delict, the dependents have access to their common law damages claim. If the death is unrelated to a road crash and not as a result of a delict, the dependents may have access to other social security benefits. Periodic payments could be used to buy life insurance. Comment, RAF 3 form or Form 3 calls for the injured person to obtain the SAPS accident report. The draft RAF 3 form was published with the 2014 revised draft bill. As with other forms, it is not part of the bill before the portfolio committee. And these forms will be reviewed and revised and again put out for comment in due course as required in terms of the PAJA Act, Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. The proposed revised draft forms provide for the following means to prove nexus. Note, if not previously submitted, a copy of one or more of the following documents which demonstrate that this claim for a benefit relates to bodily injury or death caused by or arising from the road accident. The accident report, ambulance record, hospital admission record, hospital record, witness's statement, inquest report, charge sheet, or if the documents listed above are not available, or if such documents are not available but do demonstrate that the claim relates to bodily injury or death caused by or arising out of the road accident, then attach an affidavit by a person with knowledge of the relevant facts confirming the facts that relate to the road accident and that the bodily injury or death arose from the road accident. The administrator is obliged in terms of Section 5A to assist claimants and to this end is empowered in terms of Section 45 to access information from numerous sources to identify potential claimants and render such assistance. Another comment, the administrator selects the vocational training service providers and the program to be attended. Failure to cooperate could result in termination of the benefit. The focus on RAPS is rehabilitation and return to work. The beneficiary is a participant in developing the program. Consequently, where it is possible to medically and vocationally rehabilitate a beneficiary through reskilling or upskilling to perform the same, similar, or other work,
within the beneficiary's post-accident abilities, the scheme should do so to reduce or eliminate continued reliance on the scheme. A comment on the 10,000 funeral benefit is not enough. The bill does not specify the level of the benefit, but authorizes the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance to determine the benefit regulation. Comments were made on clauses 42, 43, 2, and 56. Comment, the bill excludes the claimant or beneficiary's medical and legal costs to submit a claim. The comment is inaccurate. In as far as the bill does not exclude the claimant's or beneficiary's medical costs to submit a claim. Comment, without financial assistance, poor victims will be disqualified from claiming as it is necessary to first qualify for a claim before the benefit can be accessed. These costs are paid for by the administrator as part of the medical benefit. In accordance with subsection 31H, this benefit can be claimed by a claimant or the medical service provider. The latter will submit the claim where the claimant does not pay the service provider for the assessment, that is, where the claimant cannot afford to pay the service provider for the report. The service provider will claim the cost from the administrator. The bill does not exclude the claimant's or beneficiary's other legal costs to submit a claim, noting that the administrator is obliged in terms of Section 5A to assist claimants and to this end is empowered in terms of Section 45 to access information from numerous sources to identify potential claimants and to render assistance to the claim. Consequently, where the claimant elects not to utilize the services that already exist, the claimant must do so at his own cost. If a court awards the cost to a claimant or beneficiary subsequent to a successful review of a decision by the appeal committee, the administrator will pay such costs as provided for in the order. Currently, there are thousands of claimants who claim directly with RAF where assistance is provided and where funding is not a hindrance. 46, RAF Act allows for 5 years to claim before a claim prescribes, not 3 years as in the RAPS. This comment is inaccurate. The RAF requires the lodgement of the claim within 3 years if the insured driver is known, or within 2 years if it is a hit-and-run claim. If the claim is not lodged in these time frames, the claim prescribes. After lodgement, the claimant has 2 years or 3 years, respectively, within which to interrupt prescription permanently by serving summonses on the RAF. Extended time periods apply where a legal impediment is present. RAPS only requires lodgement within 3 years, regardless of whether it is a hit-and-run claim or not. Prescription in the bill is aligned to the Prescription Act of 1969. Comment on 46.3. Persons subject to a legal impediment have one year after the legal impediment has ceased to claim, as opposed to other persons who have 3 years. The prescription periods must be aligned. The prescription is in the bill is aligned to the Prescription Act of 69. However, alignment of the prescription regime provided for in the bill will provide for better equity. The following amendment is proposed. 3. If a qualifying person, A, is a minor or suffering from mental illness or is a person under curatorship, is prevented by superior force, including any law or any order of court, from submitting a claim, or B, is deceased, and an executor of the estate in question has not yet been appointed, the period of prescription shall not be completed before 3 years have elapsed after the relevant impediment referred to in paragraph A or B has ceased to exist. Comment, the 180 period to process a claim is unreasonable and must be reduced to 120 days. The administrator will strive to finalize claims earlier. It may not be practical to finalize all claims in the specified period, especially where expert reports are required. Consequently, a longer period is provided for. Subsection 2 provides for interest to be paid where the claim is not finalized in the specified period. Where this period is too short to allow for necessary assessment, the administrator will incur an additional liability which could materially impact the affordability and sustainability of the scheme. Comment was made on Clause 48.2. The Legal Practice Act, which is expected to come into force soon, will result in the demise of the law societies which necessitate an amendment to the current clause. It is agreed. The following amendment is proposed. The appeals committee must be composed of the following members and alternates appointed in writing by the minister. One person and or alternate, each with a legal qualification and registered as and enrolled as an advocate or an attorney under the Legal Practice Act of 2017, with no less than 10 years of practice experience in the field of law and with proven experience in the field of alternative dispute resolution. Clause 55, the jurisdiction of the courts to adjudicate a dispute has been ousted. The Constitution of the Republic of South Africa provides in Section 34 that, quote, everyone has a right to have any dispute that can be resolved by the application of law decided in a fair public hearing before a court or, where appropriate, another independent and impartial tribunal or forum. Regulation 3, made under Section 26 of the RAF Act of 96, already contains an example of such an alternative to the courts and has been in place for almost 10 years. The HPCSA adjudicated serious injury disputes and reviews are taken to the High Court. The grounds for review are extremely narrow. That's a comment. The response is, this comment is inaccurate. A decision of the appeals committee would constitute administrative action which is to be reviewed in terms of PAJA, which provides extensive grounds for review in subsection 6.2 as follows. I'm not going to read that, Chairperson. Another comment, instead of an internal appeal, the bill must provide for mediation, presumably by an external mediator. It is submitted that the appeals process and subsequent right of review is adequate, as is the case currently in Regulation 3, serious injury disputes under the RAF Act. If mediation, arbitration, then litigation and appeals or review are allowed, the time and cost will be significantly increased. Comment was made on Clause 55.2. The 30-day period to lodge an appeal is unreasonably short and will be struck down. In this regard, it is informative to know that PAJA in Section 7.1 thereof provides that any proceedings for judicial review in terms of 6.1 must be instituted without unreasonable delay and not later than 180 days. The Promotion of Access to Information Act at Section 78.2 provides that a requester may, by way of an application within 180 days, apply to court for an appropriate relief in terms of Section 82. In the case of PAYA, the above section used to provide for a 30-day period, which period the Constitutional Court in the matter of Brahma versus Minister of Social Development 2009-11 BCLR, the court declared unconstitutional. The Constitutional Court suspended its order and provided for a 180-day period, which period was later adopted by the legislature. The compensation for the Quaeda Act of 1993 in Section 91 provides any person affected by a decision of the Director General or a trade union or employers organization of which that person was a member at the relevant time, may, within 180 days after such decision lodge an objection against that decision with the commissioner in the prescribed manner. A 180-day period may be more appropriate. The following amendment is proposed. An appeal in terms of subsection 1 must be submitted to the appeals committee within 180 days after a claimant or beneficiary has been notified of a decision of the administrator or after the expiry of a period specified in Section 47.1, 57, the administrator and staff are only personally liable for intentional wrongdoing. We sourced a legal opinion on the constitutionality of this clause. Per that opinion, the clause is a codification of the existing common law in respect of liability for wrongful administrative action, and the clause will survive constitutional scrutiny. Section 62, the following deletion is proposed. The minister may prescribe any ancillary or incidental matter that is necessary to prescribe for the proper implementation or administration of this act. That comment has been agreed to. That's the end, Chairperson. So the remainder of what's there is what has been covered here. So this was a high-level document, Chairperson. We don't have to go through all of that. I thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. There we are. I will take hands from members who would want to engage with the presentation. But let me, Honorable Ramatlaka, Honorable Siband.
No, Chair. I think it's been a useful presentation that reminded us how far we come from day one. I think this is useful. It situates us in a better position to have our general discussion about the impression that we have. I don't necessarily think that it requires exchange at this point. I think that we will get into this at some point later in terms of our procedure. But, Chair, I just want to say that, just to make a comment, if I may, for the previous session, that we had with Treasury, that perhaps I should say this way, that perhaps the engagement DG with your staff may have come out quite robust, but it was never intention that we become too robust to an extent that we seem as if we're no longer friends. We remain friends, but we're two-sided table that engage in a different level. So I just want to say that in case that it came out quite robust, that I think tomorrow when we meet again, it's not meant to be any personal engagement, but it's always going to be on the issue. So if we have come across as that kind of robust, please bear with us. It's maybe it's been a long day, but bear with us. But advocate, we will continue to engage where we don't agree. That's all I wanted to register, that perhaps it may have come across quite very unfriendly, but it was not meant to be. It was really dealing with the issues and where we do not necessarily seems to be on the same page. So trying to abstract the information as gently as we can is what we're trying to do. So I just wanted to register that. Let's do apologize if we have come out fairly a bit strong to any of the officials, including the Treasury. You will convey that to her, that it was not meant to be personal, but it was really when you give the woolly answer to a simple question, it sometimes do frustrate. So we apologize for that. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Sibande.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, myself also, I'll just touch there and there, the whereby I think that we must put more cement. But the first one, which was said by my colleague, I stand by his words. that the intention was not to harm people, but is to certify ourselves in terms of compliance. And then, but I'll raise only a few. Number one is, I'll just start from the back. Number one is that one of the comment 57. You see, what I'll propose with that comment of 57, what's supposed to happen is to try and put more flesh, rather than to say that the department will source legal opinion. Because we gave you an opportunity to assist us from the legal perspective. Because to me, it's like an empty page. There wasn't a problem, but the comment, which is a problem. But how to resolve it, we left an empty page. And then also, I've noticed in some of the, if you go back as well, like in page 27, those, yes, I'm happy with that one, the grounds for review, extremely narrow, the comment which is inaccurate, because you put some of these things, that's what I mean with the last one. And then also, my colleague preempted what I wanted to raise, because he just closed me in brackets. But last one is the thing of, I thought that maybe from the Treasury, they're going to be here, the issue of methodology. You know, I thought that they were going to maybe clarify us exactly that this prescribed by the minister in consultation with the finance, that what is it exactly? That one is on page one, in the response on the NT. And, yeah, the common law has been removed, and I've noticed that. Let me leave it there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. It looks like honorable members are satisfied. I think it does not necessarily need a response, but when we keep on referring to a 10-year experience, it sort of we're shutting out other people. That you also need to take into consideration, because really, if I just come from a law school, I've got 3 years experience, and I cannot be able to be part of the decision making. It's one of those things that really, let's take that into consideration and say, how can we factor in the youth into this whole system? I would want to say that probably from my two colleagues, it was just comments. And Acting DG, we are continuing on Friday. Your last speech for your last take for the day. Friday probably will start with clause by clause, honourable members. Acting DG.
Thank you very much, honourable Chairperson and honourable members. I think it has been quite a useful engagement. We need to be to register that. And we really appreciate the comments and the input from the portfolio committee. I think we are more sharper than we arrived. We have made serious inputs, comments, also notes, which we are going to be factoring in terms of moving forward. We really appreciate and love engagements at a very robustness of it. We like it. We know that we'll remain friends, and we like that. And we will be no permanent, but we will be permanent friends. So that one is very, we'll be very happy with that. We'll be very, very, yeah. Then, Chairperson, we did engage on the 10 years with my legal team. We did debate that. But because we are still engaging on the processes, we'll look into that, because I personally had also a view that let's not close out other people who are not 10 years in the business or in the you know, in the fraternity. So let's encourage the youth to participate. So maybe we will look into that as well. My team is very much aware of that. Well, I think the more details, I think my advocate would like to get into that as per Honorable Sibande's comment in terms of the legal opinion, the departmental one. Maybe my advocate will tackle that. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think we'll make the opinion available, and no harm or malice was intended by that for not disclosing it upfront, Chairperson. And nothing is taken personal. We are happy with these engagements. We come out better persons in the end. Thank you.
Honorable members, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. We will meet Friday 9 o'clock. Venue probably is in the communique that has been sent to you. And once more, thank you. The meeting is adjourned.